reason behind the human form factor, right, that we see in humanoids now is that you essentially, you have an example of how this works really well, which is humans, and you can try to imitate from them.
So when we had this thing with the optimization problem, that's also minimizing costs, but that's while the robot is running, right? And we have a lot of code that actually feeds into these cost functions.
I mean, major limitations were essentially that anything that the robot was supposed to handle had to be inside the plan and inside this big optimization which we were doing online.
Welcome back to RobTalk, the podcast where we talk about all things robotics. And today we're doing a little bit of a deep dive. We already touched upon locomotion as a topic. We talked about the dancing robots. But today we have a special guest who knows much more about this than I do. And so I thought it would be a good time to talk with Felix Frank, who is a tech lead in our robot intelligence team. Welcome, Felix, to RobTalk.
Thank you, Clemens.
RobTalk, the Autonomous Robotics Podcast. Physical AI, no theory, just reality.
All right, and my name is Clemens, so we're going right in. Felix, tell us a little bit about your journey. Now you're working on manipulation tasks, so dealing more with the hands or the grippers of a robot. But you've come a long way until you got into our team. So how was your journey there?
Yeah, I can maybe start with when I really got into robotics, which was 2017 with a master's thesis back then. Back then I was looking at how to do certain vision-based grasps as part of a thesis at Volkswagen. And then I stayed at Volkswagen for 6 years, I think, working on different topics all the way from sim-to-real, a lot of reinforcement learning, model-based RL, time series models, but all in the context of robotics.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot of topics. But what was the application that you were dealing with at a large car manufacturing company?
So, the group that I was in at VW was mostly focused on fundamental research. So we didn't have super defined applications all the time. There were more like breakout projects where we would then try to take some of the methods which we had developed during research and use that inside the company. One example is the air pressure control inside the VW plant, where we essentially learned forecasting models for how certain compressors would work with different temperatures and different ambient conditions, and then basically combine that into a more energy efficient usage of compressed air inside the plant.
Okay, so making factories more efficient by use of data-driven methods.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah, that sums it up pretty nicely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then you moved on to working on something completely different, which was legged robotics, right?
Yeah. So basically, I started last year in March, kind of working for a US startup that works with humanoid robotics. And there I worked all over the tech stack, but specifically my main focus was on whole body control, locomotion, and how to basically use the humanoid to not just walk around, but then to also interact with the environment.
Mm-hmm. So it spans not only the legs, but also what the behavior should be when you want to actually do stuff.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's now go a little bit deeper. So last time we talked about legged robotics in the context of, for example, these dancing robots. Mm. But legged robotics goes back a lot further. So maybe you can talk a little bit about how the whole thing worked maybe 3, 4, 5, 6 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, so in legged robotics, there has basically been major changes in what is the standard methodology in order to make these robots walk and dance or do other things. Because if you think about how everything was done 10 years ago, this was mostly a very hard engineering problem where you would spend a lot of time on like tuning certain engineering controllers in order to just do the fundamental walking capabilities. So you would have a stack which basically consists of some sort of like footstep planner that would essentially maybe given a certain terrain or maybe given a certain direction that you would have to move into, would plan, okay, where do I place my feet? And then based on that, it would know the entire model of the robot, like all the kinematics, how the weights are distributed. And then you would essentially plan for the center of mass being inside like the feasible area that your like planned footsteps would allow. And then all of this would run as one big online optimization, something you would basically have to optimize at up to 1 kilohertz, and which would essentially try to balance the robot given the feet contact and given the like trajectory demands that you would have.
So this is all the idea that you can break up a problem into its constituents.
Correct.
And then solve everything independently and then in the end put it together.
Yeah, and I mean, there you would really have every small sub-problem of this would be a certain engineering problem, right? That you would spend a lot of time on modeling accurately and then solving with some custom algorithm and then basically combining it back together into a stack.
Mm.
Like, I mean, the sensor fusion alone, like how you would essentially determine how far you have moved already, that would basically require you to use your IMUs on the robot, but then also use the kinematic tree and your known joint positions and joint velocities in order to get some sort of odometry signal, fuse that with some Kalman filter-like approach and get essentially a velocity for your pelvis and then do some sort of estimation, okay, how far have I gone inside this plan? And I mean, all of this needed to work flawlessly together, and any little disturbance that you couldn't like plan for would basically break the system.
Mm-hmm. So all these sensors, it's like IMU is what we have in cell phones to determine accelerations, for example,
yeah,
or how fast you turn, or how fast you go. So we know it, but all these sensors have noise as well. And so, right then you first have to do filtering and to understand really what's going on.
I mean, one key thing if we want to go there is essentially you would need to know what feet are currently in contact with the ground, right? And if you know that your left feet, for example, is right now in contact with the ground, then basically from there you can assume it as stationary. And then you could build the kinematic tree to your other IMU locations and then fuse it based on that.
Mm-hmm.
But that basically also means you needed at least contact sensors in the feet. And most robots actually used very expensive force sensors to like get accurate estimations of, are you slipping or are you really in contact? Are you like firmly planted your feet on the ground? And I mean, all of this was a lot of hand engineering work.
Mm-hmm. Maybe just to explain a little bit, so kinematic tree is how the different pieces of the robot fit together and what the effect of one part has on the other, right?
Yes. Yeah, so I mean, essentially, if you, like from a very basic level, we know that all the joints of the robot, they have encoders where you can essentially measure the angle between inside the joint. And then since you know how you constructed your robot, you can essentially piece back together what are the locations of all the limbs, of the hands, of everything, given that you know how the like tree looks like, how things are connected to each other, and then how the angles in the important joints are. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so when you do that right, then you should get kind of a digital twin of the whole robot where which you have derived from the sensory data, right?
Correct, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I mean, I've seen this in other fields as well, that you do this kind of engineered approach. I remember 20 years ago when you went to natural language processing conferences, the problem of language processing was split up into syntax and semantics entity recognition and machine translation, and there were all these work streams that were parallel. And now it's all been replaced by ChatGPT, right? Mm. So what were the limitations of this approach that you had?
Major limitations were essentially that anything that the robot was supposed to handle had to be inside the plan and inside this big optimization which we were doing online. So even small things like if you had to have an additional contact with your hand, let's say you wanted to open a door or something, that basically needed to be included inside this plan of how the robot stabilizes itself with the context it has with its environment. So things like picking up objects, things like leaning to a wall, things like opening doors. All of these were very hard problems because you essentially had to come up with ways of how to include these extra contexts into your dynamics model and compensate for the effects that these external forces basically have on your robot. Because usually when you're just walking in free space, and I mean, let's say you're just on a flat surface, right? Then you have a very defined contact. You have basically a flat floor and you have your 2 feet, and those are the only contacts you're dealing with. And when you're walking, it's basically, you can kind of think of it as controlled falling, right? You're like leaning forward, you're falling forward, and then you're catching yourself with your feet. And if you're doing that in the right dynamic way, then the contacts you have with your feet, they basically absorb the like gravity that would just push you to the ground. But if you now add another contact, you want to open the door, then you basically have to compensate for these extra forces, which now propagate from your hand to the rest of your body. And I mean, humans do this very well because we spend countless hours as children playing and trying all different sorts of things. If you look at this as an engineering problem and you try to hand tune and optimize for all of these special situations online, that becomes very, very cumbersome and challenging.
Mm. So the idea is there that you would be somehow able to engineer walking in the real world, where the real world is just a very, very unordered, semi-structured domain. Yeah. And so maybe that thinking was a little bit too simplistic then. Yeah. What did you actually optimize for? Like you said, it's an optimization problem, but what kind of error would you try to minimize there?
The main thing you would try to minimize would basically be the overall actions that you would have to do. But the bigger thing in this optimization problem is the constraints that you have. Because you have your footstep planning. And then you know that, okay, if my feet have to be there, so those are already constraints on the kinematic structure, because you know, okay, my left foot has to be at a certain place, my right foot has to be in the air or also at a certain place. And then given that, you would know, okay, where does my center of mass have to be? And that basically already places your body in a certain location. And then if you now add manipulation on top of that, you would have certain end effector target positions, like where your hands or where your elbow or something like that is supposed to be. And merging all of these constraints basically leaves you with a limited set of options. And then you usually just distinguish between them by something that uses the least amount of overall torque or something that, some constraint is also keeping your body upright, these sort of things. But then the actual minimization is not the key thing. It's just some additional variables that you would basically use to figure out, okay, out of the remaining solution space, like where do I actually want to go to?
Mm. So you're saying part of the engineering is to come up actually with the right costs and to design them in the right way. One of them is energy minimization.
Yeah.
Right, but then there could be a lot of other constraints.
Yeah, I mean, it could also be that you want to be as fast as possible, which then influences how you place your feet and so on. Yeah. Mm.
So, I mean, people got already quite far if you work on this problem, like for 10 years. I remember, I mean, there were robots doing parkour kind of movements already like 5, 6, 7 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, the Atlas robot from Boston Dynamics is kind of a really good example for how good you can actually get if you really perfect this technique. And I mean, it showed really impressive capabilities in terms of not just walking, but also running, the parkour you just mentioned. It did backflips, all these sort of things with just, yeah, a lot of engineering work, basically.
Mm. So many years of tuning and fine-tuning, yes, to get to a certain level. Okay, but people got really to some kind of boundary there, like a frontier that, you know, where they couldn't get better.
Yeah.
Or suddenly we had a shift. So what was that kind of shift?
Yeah, I think the as you said, for language, right, people were looking at ways to basically, instead of doing all the like splitting up in sub-problems and doing a lot of engineering on each sub-problem and then combining it back to a bigger architecture, the idea was, okay, how can we approach this problem more from a learning perspective? So we essentially want to use data in order to, yeah, and then some sort of black box function approximator like a neural network, right? And try to solve some of these sub-problems or try to solve, like entire parts of the stack end-to-end from learning. And I mean, if we, it's a bit hard to pinpoint the exact like time when this shifted, but I guess for quadrupeds, this was a bit earlier. I think the earliest quadrupeds paper were like that really showed proper walking without any major engineering around it, was around 2019 to 2020. And then humanoids came a bit later, more like 2023 to 2024. So actually not that long ago. And there were a bunch of things that were necessary in order to make this happen. For humanoids specifically, the availability of cheap humanoids was like super important, because 20 years ago, you could only do research on humanoids in a few labs that basically had built their own custom humanoid. And this was expensive, this was brittle. And by now, I mean, we have humanoids kind of as a consumer product. Not that they're incredibly useful to like an average person, but as a research tool, they're quite good.
Mm-hmm. So that was the whole Cheetah development from MIT, I guess?
Yeah, Cheetah development from MIT, but then for humanoids, Unitree, the G1. I mean, this was quite important.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, if we look in terms of shift of the methodology, the real key thing that happened is that we got also GPU parallelizable simulations. That was a bit earlier, but I mean, using this for humanoids or for quadrupeds, for locomotion in general, it was around that time. And the key thing is that a lot of these learning methods, they're not very data efficient. But if you have simulators that can just produce endless amounts of data in a very short amount of time, you can basically use that to still learn good and robust behaviors.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then there's now two new developments, right? One is this repetition of a human motion,
mm-hmm,
and then there's the much more open-ended domain of actually solving a task. So maybe let's go again really quickly into this repetition part of the work.
I would actually split it a bit finer, because so if you look at locomotion in general, there it wasn't purely like trying to repeat what humans are doing from the start. There it was really you essentially have a simulation which has your robot inside, so some digital twin of your actual hardware. And then you would essentially do what we call reinforcement learning, which is trial learn by trial and error kind of. The human wasn't in the loop at that point in time. So you would essentially have custom reward functions that would consist out of 10 to 15 terms, something like that, that would cover everything from, do you keep your upper body upright? You have to lift your feet more than X centimeters into the air. You have to make sure that you stay close to some default pose. You have to follow a certain velocity command. And then a bunch of more terms basically all around this. And here there was no external data involved. So the only way that data would get into the process is through the simulation. So you would essentially randomly initialize policies, and they would have to try and make this humanoid or quadruped or robot in general walk. And the only signal it would get is that it had to follow a certain velocity trajectory. So it had to go forward, backward, left, right, whatever. Based on the custom cost function, this would be some sort of reward shaping problem where you essentially learn policies that then fulfill all of those rewards as good as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of amazing because these policies then are really robust. So one key thing is you only learn them in simulation and you basically never see any sort of real robot data. But there's a technique which is called domain randomization, where you essentially, inside your simulator, you vary the physics so much that your robot has to learn, or your policy has to learn, a very robust behavior, which basically fits to any sort of variance inside, like that concerns physics. So different mass distributions inside your robot, different friction parameters, also small variations in the kinematic structure, or all these sort of things that you would randomize in simulation. And then the resulting policy would basically be good enough that it can be transferred to the robot zero shot. So you would spend a lot of time tuning the simulation and tuning the rewards now. So the engineering problem kind of went away from we like hand tune all these algorithms for the sub problems to we tune the simulation, we tune the reward functions, and then we would spend hours inside the simulator training policies and then getting robust behavior out, which would work on the real robot.
So let me try to understand the difference between the stuff we talked about before a little bit better. So when we had this thing with the optimization problem, that's also minimizing costs, but that's while the robot is running, right? And we have a lot of code that actually feeds into these cost functions. Whereas in reinforcement learning, we try to learn a model upfront, right? But we do it in a way that we get feedback from data. In this case, the data is generated through the simulator. Yeah. Is that how I?
That's a pretty good summary. Yeah. The whole idea behind learning a neural network for such a problem would basically be that this complicated optimization problem gets amortized into a function approximator. So essentially, in the end, this neural network outputs a solution to this complicated optimization problem without actually running an actual optimization online, but it has tried this a lot of times before in simulation and has gotten so good at it that kind of the zero shot answer is good enough that you can keep the system running. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there is no online optimization running at all anymore?
There are works where you then do certain online adaptations to the real world. There is a whole line of papers which basically goes in this direction, that you learn a fairly robust model in sim, and then online you basically adapt to your real robot in real time. But let's say the standard approach does not have any more online optimization running. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Except for, technically the state estimation, a lot of people still relied on classical state estimation. So you would have some Kalman filter that essentially estimates the velocity of your center of mass. And that is also some sort of an optimization running there, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it still requires quite a bit of domain knowledge about how the robot actually works in terms of physics. Yeah. So we have simulators now which can just deal with a good chunk of what we know about physics.
Yeah,
just has to be Newtonian physics. So that's a well known thing. And the surprising thing, I guess, is that you take such a model from the simulator and you just apply it to the real world, and we saw that it just works, right?
Mm, yeah. The key here is the technique I mentioned before, the domain randomization. It's really to make your simulation as robust or like as diverse as possible, such that your policy has to learn a very robust behavior. There were also works where you essentially had a lot of domain randomization in sim, and then part of your model was some sort of adaptation, which essentially figured out, okay, what are the specific physics I'm dealing with right now, and then would be specialized towards that. But yeah, overall, the key is that your simulation basically displays such a wide variety of physics, which are all realistic and which come down to like difference in like the floor you're walking on, or differences in like the manufacturing of the robot, because you're not going to get the same robot twice. So that your policy basically had to learn to be robust to all of these perturbations.
I remember two lines of work there. One is that you would even also make the shape of the robot a variable of this whole thing. So the robot could actually start to look different in order to solve a particular problem. And the other is that you would just throw things between the legs and really try to have the robot stumble and recover from it.
I mean, a big part of the randomization aspect was also external pushes. So the robot would basically be trained while constantly being pushed around and shoved around, and it would have to be robust to all of this. So this is also where it comes in, that if you suddenly bump into certain things, or if you stumble over a small step or something like that, your policy has seen variations of this by being shoved around the entire time, and it's like good at absorbing this shock and then trying to continue nonetheless.
So if we do all of this, are we getting motion behavior that resembles that of a human?
No. Okay, so this is where now the human aspect comes in. So there's basically two lines of like research that kind of converged at some point. And the one line is what you basically mentioned before, which is imitating certain motions that a human does. So the entire architecture there is, you take a human and the human does a certain motion. I don't know, he walks or he runs or something like that. And then you would use motion capture suits, and you would essentially capture exactly how the human skeleton moves while doing this sort of motion. And then the idea is to, instead of using custom cust functions, which basically shape the solution landscape for the policy in a way that you hand engineer, like you stay upright, you lift your feet and this sort of stuff. And instead you basically change to, okay, I just want to be like, I want to track what the human is doing. I basically want to imitate exactly the motion which was done and which was presented by the human. And there's a few key things in there that you need to do. One is called retargeting. So the idea is, you have a human motion and the human skeleton has the number of bones that it has, but now your robot looks certainly different. It's bigger, smaller, it has like certainly a different kinematic structure. And you essentially need to, through the retargeting process, take the motion which the human was doing and map it on a motion which is doable by your robot given the kinematic constraints. So retargeting is one thing. And then in the second step, you would essentially learn a policy, and now the only reward for this policy would basically be, okay, stay as close as possible to the kinematic trajectory, which is coming from the retargeting. And then you get away with all the custom reward tuning, which you have to do. And it boils down to, track what the human is doing. So this is line one. It's like, I guess started 2018 probably with like Deep Mimic works like around that, where the first time we had these sort of reward functions which are solely based on tracking a human. And then there's another line of work which basically integrates with what we talked about before, is custom cost function learning, where the idea was, okay, now I don't want to track a specific motion, but I basically want to have movements which are closer to what the human is doing. So there's a technique called adversarial motion priors, where the idea is you learn a discriminator essentially, which tries to tell if the motion that it's seeing is coming from a human or not. And then part of the reward for like learning how to walk would essentially be fooling that discriminator. So looking like you're walking like a human. And that way you could essentially for the first time add human data to these sort of like learned policies, and they would not only have to walk and stay upright and like move forward and so on, but they would also have to try and be like look close to what a human is doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I mean, it all boils down to always, in some sense, the same thing. We give it some target to learn. Now we're shifting that target, and then we measure the difference to what we actually want to see, and then we can trickle down the errors through a very defined process with neural nets, right? Called backpropagation.
Yeah.
Where we then adjust the model, and somehow then we see when we do it right that it actually over time becomes better and better at yeah. doing that.
Yeah.
Okay. So the other development is that you want to take out more and more of this this manual tuning, or like pretty much remove code that you actually need to train such a thing, and yeah. reduce it more and more to a data centric problem.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this then goes to like the let's say current gold standard that current way that most humanoid manufacturers and also companies try to solve this, which is essentially you get even more data driven, and instead of imitating single motions, you're basically trying to learn policies that can imitate a generic set of motions. So you would capture a large data set of humans doing different locomotion modes, and that can range anywhere from walking, running, you can also have stair climbing, you can have crawling, you can have any type of moving around as a human, also with different styles. I've seen data sets where you have a happy walking style and a drunken walking style and an injured walking style. And you would basically take all of this data, and you would now learn to... You would first still do the retargeting, so that kind of the engineering shifted away from custom cost functions and now towards like doing retargeting really well, which is also a tricky problem in and of itself. But once you have essentially your retargeted data set, you can imagine you have a large set of motions which your robot can do kinematically, but you now have to learn a policy that can essentially deal with all of them in terms of compensating for the physics that happened during executing those motions. So there was a paper from NVIDIA last year called Sonic. There's a bunch of other works around this, but that's probably the most well-known, where you really turn this into a big data problem, because they collected, I think, on the order of 700 to 1,000 hours of humans doing different types of locomotion behavior. And then you would retarget all of this, and you would essentially learn policies that have to deal with the entire variety of it. So they have to be really robust to all different sorts of contexts, because, I mean, it's a very different problem if you walk, where you have these like two defined contexts with your feet on the ground, or if you are crouching around, where you maybe be on your knees, or you're like you have a full body contact and you're you're really using your entire body in contact with the environment to move around.
Mm-hmm. And if we take this retargeting problem, it all hints to why, even if we're not solving leg robotics in particular, the fact that we're trying to learn as much from humans as possible, it still makes sense to sort of follow the humanoid form factor, right? The humanoid kinematics and having arms and so on.
I mean, that's a big reason behind the human form factor, right? That we see in humanoids now is that you have an example of how this works really well, which is humans, and you can try to imitate from them. But I mean, one thing to be very careful about is that for locomotion, this, I mean, is not solved, but like we got quite far, because we have the tools for recording humans moving in the world with like motion capture systems for quite a while. But when you now look at manipulation, it's much harder, because you have very fine contacts with small objects, and like a typical motion capture system wouldn't even capture these sort of forces. So there you really need something else.
Mm-hmm. But okay, let's stick to the locomotion for a little bit. So one thing that what we've been talking about was mostly the robot being completely blind and deaf, right?
Correct, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So how far do we get when the robot doesn't have eyes and other senses?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, what you can get out of it, right, is a really good whole body controller that basically knows how to control the humanoid to walk around, to move around, to be robust to different, like, small variations in the terrains. If there are small steps, that's usually not a problem. And they're also robust to a certain amount of contact, so they can bump into walls or they can be flat on the ground and still move around. That's fine. But I mean, there's a whole line of research that is this sort of terrain aware motions, where you would then try to walk upstairs or do other things that basically need some sort of knowledge. I mean, we know that blind stair walking can kind of still work. I mean, humans can also do it as long as the stairs are normed, right? But it breaks at the level where suddenly there's a drop, or you have a ladder where you have to really hit the individual rungs, I guess. And if you are just off by a few centimeters, it's basically a catastrophic failure, right? I mean, that's where the blind policies, where they reach their limit.
Mm-hmm. And so now you might need to know much more about the semantics of the environment, know what a ladder is or know what stairs are, and also do some kind of prediction, right? Where you would have to be in a few seconds.
Yeah, so I mean, the current lines of work, they go along this direction kind of, that you have some sort of component that is basically terrain aware, and then often this is some sort of laser scan of your environment, like exactly your surrounding areas in some sort of grid, what's the Z value, like what's the height of that specific point in space. And then you have some component that takes this terrain and essentially plans ahead some sort of motion, although this planning is very implicit. It's just like usually this happens in some sort of latent space, that both the planner component and then also this blind whole body locomotion component, they have to know the same sort of space or like way of talking with each other. And then the planner component basically deals with gets a high level command, hey, you want to be at point XY, and then it knows, okay, in order to get there, I have to walk up or down, and basically generates an appropriate motion trajectory, which then the low level blind component just follows and is robust to certain perturbations.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like this is still a little bit in the research space.
Yeah, I would say this is the kind of edge of current research, like how to have not just terrain aware, but also then intent aware, like how to combine now these blind locomotion or whole body policies with a higher level intent, like you have to do a certain thing, you have to interact with the environment in a certain way, or you have to go in a certain place in your terrain, right? Like combining these two things, that's kind of the current edge of research, I would say.
Right, and that is currently not fully data driven. You still have to put up some engineering again, like we used to do for the other parts as well.
I would say that we're getting closer and closer to it being data driven. So there's more and more works on having this planner component also from data. So you essentially have humans walking upstairs or vaulting over boxes, and then you kind of learn, okay, how do these motion trajectories look? And you start to combine, or you start to do this end-to-end learned. But overall, yeah, there's still a lot of open problems in that aspect.
So it means if I have a flat surface, like I have in factories, I mean, the alternative is to use wheeled robots, of course. So maybe out of your practical experience, can you tell me a bit about what it is to actually do research with these LECT robots and what the challenges there are?
Yeah, I mean, in general, doing research with LEGT Robotics or like working with them is quite challenging. You need a lot to work well in order to be able to do anything at all. Because, I mean, if you just assume that there's no power, the humanoid will basically just collapse and fall down. So whenever you're experimenting, you're usually doing it with some sort of patient carrier or something that essentially holds your robot in place when it's off or when there's no power or in case of any sort of failure. So you need a physical harness around your robot that basically makes sure it's like safe to operate around. And I mean, if you really want to work with a LEGT robot, it kind of needs to be on battery because you want to walk around. It cannot be tethered anymore. So there's a whole lot of complications that you basically add simply because in its natural form, the system is not stable, right? If you don't do anything, it just falls down and is on the ground and doesn't do anything anymore.
Yeah, and we've seen that in some very embarrassing public presentations as well.
We've seen that in very recent demos, actually, yes. That this still happens. I mean, any sort of small issue, being it like the power of the robot or being it some sort of code failure, right? If you run into some critical state, the robot will basically just collapse and fall to the ground, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so, I mean, that all points to, from a safety perspective, obviously a fixed robot might be a bit more stable, and also wheeled robots might be more stable than an electric robot.
Yeah, I think in general, right, a fixed robot is obviously can be tethered, is fixed in place, like if it usually has certain brakes, if power goes out, it just stays there. But also a wheeled robot, right? I mean, the wheeled system in and of itself, I mean, the way it's designed, it's stable. So it won't fall over, it won't collapse if there's no power. So you can basically just put it someplace, turn off the power and wait. Whereas for a humanoid, you would essentially have to hang it somewhere or like put it into a certain fixture that keeps it in place.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so a lot of challenges on the LEGT robots. Also, quite a bit of power consumption as well, which we haven't really talked about. So, but I think this rounds it up the whole topic a bit. So, thank you, Felix, for being on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, hope you enjoyed it as well, and I hope please share this episode if you liked it and subscribe. And we're gonna see each other hopefully soon in the next version when it says Rob Talk.
This is Rob Talk, a podcast by Robco. Subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube. See you on the factory floor.